The transgender mandate in schools is about determining truth and forcing you to believe it, or at least to lie. That's the topic of Last Impressions 37. I'm Justin Katz. The basic topic I want to address today has to do with the Rhode Island Department of Education is at the behest of the Rhode Island ACLU, transforming what had been guidance, some suggested policies that the state thought maybe Rhode Island's public schools should follow when it comes to students who have gender dysphoria, who are transgender, doubt their gender, as they say, that they were assigned at birth. The one associated with their biology, that have doubts about that. The state of Rhode Island is now poised to impose a statewide regulation on all public schools, at least for now, just public schools, on how to handle that. And it's not to get ahead of myself here, but it's a very strongly worded guidance. Whatever any advocates tell you, we're not just talking about being able to use the same bathrooms or even call children by the names they prefer or even pronouns and he, she, z, whatever. We're talking about much more than that, where as very early on, schools, the teachers and the faculty will be tasked with determining and spotting signs of transgender feelings, gender dysphoria, and helping to advance that, move that forward for students. In high school, it goes so far as to hide this, help students hide this from parents. And important to this conversation is that it also explicitly calls for schools to what I would characterize as re-educating any other students who are uncomfortable. So basically, the problem with this, as I would articulate it, is that this isn't just a policy to have ensure that students who have these feelings are not excluded from the educational opportunities offered in public schools. That is not the objectionable part of this policy. What the policy does is it imposes from the state level restrictions on local districts and the individuals who make them up, the employees and the students and the community. It forbids them from resolving these issues in a way that might make sense in their particular circumstances. So it calls for, essentially, it dictates the left-wing view of transgenderism as the policy to be imposed on every school in Rhode Island, period. So that's where I'm going with this. I wanted to preface it with an interesting point, and I think very, very, in a sense of larger political philosophy, an important point made by Megan McArdle, who appeared on the Econ Talk podcast recently with Russ Robert. And this is Megan McArdle, and making an interesting point about tangential issues, but ones that I believe are related.
There's people who are now feeling afraid because they might say something that isn't just telling a terrible racist joke, but suggesting that maybe women and men have different interests and are not going to be equally represented at tech companies. And that even some of those interests might be genetic. And this is something that I'm a woman. I'm in a pretty male field. I've always done pretty male jobs. And it doesn't in any way offend me. If it's true, it's true. The universe isn't here to please me. Right? And as you pull those things in, you create this climate of everyone feeling like they have to lie in public. And what's interesting to me about reading those Soviet era things is how many people, Orwell talks about this, Václav Havel talks about this, is the feeling that making you tell a lie is the point. That there's no like greater point of what you're saying except that they have undermined your character by forcing you to lie for the regime, is that they're making you weaker.
So the idea here is that in this world of political correctness and speech codes and things you're not allowed to say, things you can be fired for saying, things you can be ostracized and prevented from working and making a living, in that world, the sense that it seems a lot like the culture that existed in it, say Orwell's 1984 or the Soviet Union, and people in those circumstances, and certainly Orwell thought this, as McArdle pointed out, they feel like that's the point. The point of the government, the government's just making you lie, not because it necessarily cares what you're saying one way or another, but because if it can make you say something you don't believe, then you are broken. You are weak. It can control you. You never know what you can say. You always just have to repeat back what they tell you. And so you cease to be an autonomous human being to the extent that that's possible. And God did not allow that fully. But that's the objective of totalitarian societies. That's sort of the feeling a lot of us have, especially with the adamance with which so many principles like freedom of speech, parental rights, smaller government, local rights, so many of these principles are being thrown out the window, and it feels a lot like the idea is just, it's all just a power play, as if the government doesn't really care about the people who it puts forward as its emblems and its excuses, but is really just trying to impose its will, period. That's the goal. Maybe that's unfair, maybe it's not, but it could also be, you know, the left, progressives, totalitarians, the kind of people who want to control everybody in society, who think they're so right, they feel this need to impose their views on everybody, or maybe they're just so insecure they can't believe what they believe if anybody doubts it or is free to doubt it. But it could be that these folks are just resurgent in the United States. So it's not so much they want to make us lie and that's the goal. Maybe they will always try to impose their views, whatever those views are. And then they happen to be in power now. So if the cliche is that, and this has come up recently in some Facebook discussions I've been having, the cliche is that, you know, the left was all for freedom of speech. When they're in the minority, it's all about the individual's rights to speak their mind and have conscience. When they take the reins, suddenly it flips and you're not allowed. Everything you believe that they don't is beyond the pale. I mean, of course we want to have freedom, but that's just too far. This belief that everybody had about, say, gay relationships just a few years ago, that's just beyond the pale now. It was always, you can't even have that free speech. So on one hand, it feels like you're just trying to get you to lie. On the other hand, there are probably plenty of people who believe what they advocate as far as transgenderism, language like the sex they were assigned at birth, meaning the one that was aligned with their biology. So people believe that, but now that they're in power, they're willing to impose that view. Of course, it could go both ways. I'm kind of rambling here, but it's kind of a big thought. But it could also go there are lots of ways that we can get into this situation and a lot of different perspectives people can have in dragging us there. And it's important, I think, to brainstorm a bit about what those could be. So it could be that people who believe these things are now willing to impose them and they now have power, so they're able to. It could also be that people who mainly want to be on the side of goodness and with the side of, which means to them the side of power, the kind of people who want to impose views, whatever those views are, on other people, gravitate now toward the views that you have to hold in order to do that. But that could be another possibility. But mainly I wanted to structure... I wanted to address a few things I heard in a debate that my boss at the Center for Freedom and Prosperity, Mike Stenhouse, held when he was substituting, pinch hitting. Obviously, he used a baseball metaphor, being a former baseball player. But he was substituting for Dan York on WPRO. And he hosted a debate on the ACLU's push to have the Rhode Island Department of Education impose its mandates, its guidelines on transgenderism on all schools as a mandatory regulation. And he had on his guests as his guests for that, the ACLU, Rhode Island ACLU lawyer, Marcella Bettencourt, and a doctor who takes the other side, Quentin Van Meter. And I want to offer, before I get into this, a disclaimer that this isn't about the kids who feel this way, the students, the children, the teenagers, young adults. I'm not trying to minimize their experience in any way. And frankly, I'm not even at this, in this context, trying to dictate or even really suggest a way that they ought to be handled and that ought to act and that their community ought to handle them. I'm not trying to do that here. My focus is on rights and how we structure rights and self-governance and how we make decisions. That is the bigger issue, that no matter how you feel about this issue, we really need to come to some kind of consensus on our rights when it comes to that larger issue, the issue of how we all can get along and each live our reality, which is supposed to be something that liberals, progressives, whatever, advocate. Obviously, like free speech, that could be the kind of thing they advocate until they're in power, and then suddenly it's no longer such a big deal to allow everybody to define their own reality. Suddenly it's, no, that's not acceptable because your reality makes me feel bad. But not on, I'm trying not to get on these tangents, but so in Sten's debate with hosting the debate with these two, I want to start at the beginning when Bettencourt, so she gave her a little spiel, and then Dr. Van Meter came on and said, look, I oppose this because I don't believe the science behind saying this helps students in the first place. And then Bettencourt rejoins with this.
My expertise or knowledge comes from a very different place than the doctor. I come from a policy background rather than a medical one.
Understood.
So it would have been great to have a medical professional instead. But I do want to say that we did have, as part of our petitioners, there were several health organizations, mental health and physical health organizations, that actually were part of our petition that would, for medical and psychological reasons, disagree with the doctor. Again, I can only speak to the knowledge that I have, and that regards policy.
So, you know, that's, on a first analysis, that's a fair statement to make. Look, I'm not going to try to contest his science because I'm not a scientist. There are other people you could have on who would offer that. I'm going to focus on my area of expertise. But on the other hand, thinking of it a little more deeply, she's an advocate for this issue. She's making this a focus to the point, to the degree that she's one of the more prominent people in the state advocating for this issue. So how can she not know what the arguments are? How can she not know the science? How can she not be able to articulate that at least well enough for a 30-second clip on the radio? I mean, to say these doctors with whom I agree say this. How can she not? I mean, did it matter to her? So how, if you're advocating for this, and again, if you're advocating to have the state impose mandatory regulations on all schools in the state, how those public schools must handle these situations, if you're going to advocate for that, how can you not be convinced that there's some great injustice and thing going on here, and either say, well, that injustice outweighs, even if it does harm? I mean, that's kind of the question I would like to hear answered. Does it matter? If Dr. Van Meter's points are completely true, if he won a scientific debate, say, would you change your position? Would you no longer be trying to impose this on children, on schools? And if so, then how can you do it if you can't articulate the basics of why you disagree? That I think is one thing we ought to often look for in these debates, is, and maybe make it a point of asking, what if you were wrong about the science? Would you change your policy? Would you have a different view? Or would you just say, no, you know what, this principle of rights and freedom is just so important that even if children are harmed, which was essentially Van Meter's claim, then it doesn't matter because the greater good of freedom is more important. That's the first point I wanted to make. And now here's another one that comes up again and again as the left tries to equate everything with the civil rights movement and bringing Black Americans to equality. And this is really a key issue here.
So I guess the question is, why is the rights of the few more important than the rights of the many?
And if I can say, so that the same thing that you are mentioning of why violate the rights of, or make some people uncomfortable for the rights of others, that's the same thing that they used to see in the 60s with integration. So why integrate a school and make some people uncomfortable when they can be in a school separate or different somewhere else? So it's the same conversation and rhetoric that people have been using for decades to defend discrimination. And in the place where this country is, this is no longer something that we should be abiding by just because it makes a couple of people uncomfortable.
If you think about it, that sort of argument really should be hugely offensive, pretty much across the political spectrum. I mean, it ought to be the kind of thing we look at as like a high school debate team tactic. So in the case of transgenderism, the civil rights claim is entirely about the discomfort, at least at this level of schools and school policy. The claim is that the students are, they have a right to an education. That's where this begins. They have a right to equal treatment in their education. And if they are uncomfortable in school, then they can't realize that right. That's where this claim originates. By contrast, Blacks under segregation weren't even allowed to be uncomfortable in the same schools. They were locked out. They were blocked. They couldn't get through the door. They couldn't enter a situation of mutual discomfort or even their own discomfort. You know, even if the white students weren't discomfort, that was forbidden. So gender dysphoric students, they can still be educated. They can still go to the schools, interact with the students. I fully expect that individual schools would and should have some sort of policy and some sort of way fitting their community and working with everybody in their community to make sure that went as smoothly as possible for everybody without a state down mandate. But if the discomfort of the students, the transgender students, is impinging on their right to be educated, making it such that they cannot be educated, then treating other students with other worldviews as if they're lesser, as if they have to change, as if something's wrong with them in the educational environment, as if they should be excluded and changed in order to be more like everybody else. If that discomfort, how does that not do the same thing, impinge on their right to an education? I would imagine if you're coming from home and your family has a set of beliefs that is contrary to what you are being told you must believe in school, that can be a very disrupting thing to your education. So the ACLU here is picking sides. It's saying civil rights equals my beliefs. I mean, put it into, as I like to do, put it in almost algebraic terms. You know, under policy A, one student feels uncomfortable. Under policy B, the other does. In a case of civil rights with racial discrimination, it was literally a question of access. This is a question of whose discomfort the state privileges and whose it will not tolerate or whose it will accept. It'll accept that you're uncomfortable because the state privileges that other person's feelings over yours. And let's not forget, maybe perhaps the most offensive part of that whole argument, of Bettencourt's whole argument, is we're talking about forms of discrimination that are arguably so different as to be completely distinct things altogether. Now, racial discrimination, apart from even not being able to get in the door, racial discrimination was the legacy of centuries of discrimination and even slavery. And that was all bound up in a heritable racial quality. The quality that caused the discrimination was passed on from parent to child to child to child. And that made it conceivable to create this racial underclass and that just simply couldn't break free of discrimination, that was locked in because of this sort of conspiracy of racism. That's what made it justified for the government to step in and start picking sides in that regard. Of course, the left has grabbed on that and said, look, this is a great weapon. Let's make it more widely applicable. Anything we can phrase to be like that will therefore allow us to impose our views on everybody else. So, for one thing, these new claims of identity rights, whether transgender or orientation more broadly, they're not, as far as we know, heritable. And they can't be bound up in a systematic society-wide discrimination over generations. It's just not feasible. You can't create an underclass of people simply by virtue whose parents and children and on in generations will be excluded in that kind of a way. And honestly, it just seems like either this profound ignorance or maybe terrible cynicism to even compare the two. And incidentally, to get back toward the topic, there's more, again, as I said at the beginning, there's more to this policy than being uncomfortable about, say, sharing a bathroom. We're talking about, and not only actually the pronouns, and we're talking about parents' rights to convey their values to their own children. That is the right that is being sacrificed in the name of the American Civil Liberties, ironically, Union, and their mission here. And we see that when we get back to another thing that Bettencourt said that ought to be, well, disturbing at least.
So in circumstances like this, when there are parents that believe the medical claims that the doctor is making rather than other nationally recognized organizations, they might not support their child's transitioning. So it doesn't say that school is going to hide it. All it says is that the school will not share information that they don't need to.
So she's explicitly saying that parents with different views from her will be locked out. She explicitly says that parents who honestly, she understates what the policy does. It explicitly talks about helping the student to keep this information from their parents. So I don't know if she's just spinning or outright lying, but that's not correct what she said. But even so, she explicitly is saying that the parents who believe one doctor, the doctor whom she acknowledged she is not qualified to argue against, so she can argue he's wrong to the point of excluding parents from decisions about their children, but she doesn't know the issue well enough to argue against her on the air for the benefit of people interested in this topic. But she's saying that if these parents believe this one doctor, then they're suspect. They're suspect of child abuse. They're suspect of not wanting to be progressive and good citizens, and they might not support the child's doing what we want the child to do. This is unbelievable stuff, and it's almost hard to believe that it's being spoken on the radio like this so openly. But again, she can't even articulate the other side's medical claims. She just accepts it as on faith, I guess, that this is a good thing. And it brings you back to the question of how did she make up her own mind? If she doesn't know why this guy, this doctor, is wrong, then how did she make up her own mind and make up her own mind so strongly that she believes the government ought to muscle in on parents' relationships with their children? Now, folks, this just gets to much bigger questions about how we should make decisions as a society. Dr. Van Meter spoke later in the interview addressing the actual data and science that's available. And this ought to be, again, very disturbing.
Well, the basic science research that's been done, the therapeutic modalities that have been used and documented for the past 40 years show that affirmation of a transgender identity is harmful and results in unequivocal damage emotionally, increases suicide rates. The
research has shown that?
Yes, research has shown that. And we already
know. And you can cite it off air if I need to?
I'd be happy to do that. We can just look at the name Kenneth Zucker and look at his, until his name was expunged from the literature references by the American Psychological Association mm-hmm. and the Endocrine Society. Everybody who has a standard opinion based on the long-acting, long-standing science that's already been documented in regard to transgender, every one of those things has been expunged as if it never existed, not with the permission of the people, not with a balanced approach. It was mentioned that the major medical societies speak in favor right. of transgender, and they are basically societies right. that have committees made of only people with one opinion, no balanced approach, no balanced presentation, right. and they basically made a decision on social wishes and hopes and no science.
So let me try to frame this objectively. We have basically two perspectives. From the ACLU's perspective on Dr. Van Meter's claim about people being expunged from the debate and the literature, from the ACLU's perspective, these major credible medical organizations have come to a conclusion somehow, however they do that. And at least it wasn't so outrageous that somebody sued them for fraud or something like that. From the doctor's perspective, those very organizations, which are not government organizations, they're private organizations that have membership rules and liberties that come with being private organizations. But from the doctor's perspective, those very organizations have been making basically political decisions and erasing contrary voices from the discussion. So they made their decision, this is what we're going to believe, and if you disagree, you're not allowed to be part of this. So that's the doctor's perspective. Now, objectively, the next step is that the government takes this finding from these private organizations and considers it as a legitimate basis to pick a side in the culture and impose essentially a worldview from the top down on children and families in every school in Rhode Island, every public school in Rhode Island. Objectively, that's what's going on here. So just analyzing this objectively, we have no reason to think. I mean, we can observe what's going on with the state, right? They're saying, hey, this is just truth. I mean, as Betancourt articulated, this is just it. We want children should be able to be free to change their genders and hide it from their parents, and schools ought to help them along in that. And if other students are uncomfortable, the schools ought to change those other students' minds so that they're comfortable with this other person doing what they think is right and all that kind of thing. But it's a top-down, one-sided push that has to be imposed from the top down, and other people's views are just invalidated. They're not allowed. Once the decision's made, you would have to essentially overthrow Rhode Island government in order to change it. There's no reason not to kind of think that this same approach to decision-making applied in the medical organizations that expunged the dissenters, especially if Betancourt and others who are advocating for this aren't willing or able to articulate in a language that we can understand why the medical organizations are behaving this way. So as a general sort of a general rule, this sort of thing, this sort of approach ought to send up red flags. I mean, if the people who are articulating who are pushing these policies through government to impose rules broadly can't tell us in language we can understand, and at the point at which all the research is supposed to become public debate about a policy that represents us and our worldviews, then we really have no meaningful right to self-government in this country anymore, at least in Rhode Island. And that ought to be a huge concern, even to people who think that the ACLU and the Department of Education are heading in the right direction. That ought to be really the focus of this debate, and it's not. And a lot of people, we're not really hearing a lot about this debate in the news media. And so it makes you wonder whether what mix of, again, there probably multiple factors at play, different personalities, different reasons people behave, but it certainly feels like the news media and the people who are supposed to be sort of hosting the public debate have just picked a side, and the other side isn't even going to be offered the courtesy of a fair hearing or fair information. I mean, claims that Van Meter makes would be, I think, shocking. I mean, not shocking. People would probably agree with it, a lot of Rhode Islanders, but shocking to hear, because we're just not allowed to hear those kinds of things anymore. It's been decided. This is just the way it's going to be. And that's not a healthy position for us to be in, because this issue aside, affecting probably a very small number of people, we're being prepped to be ruled. Just like, as McArdle said earlier, the idea is that the totalitarian society wants to make you lie, because if it takes away your character and keeps you always guessing what you're supposed to believe, you're putty to be controlled, to be manipulated. Same thing is going on here. There's a proof of principle. If they can push this thing through, other things can be pushed through too. It's like water. When it leaks or when it runs down your yard and it finds a path, and that path could be arbitrary. Just as it's able to move, as government's able to impose a view on people, just this little stream, a little trickle gets from the top down to the bottom where they want you to go. Then that's already started, and you can more water will follow that path. And the principles that got that forward, the principles that the school, for example, has, well, like the principles of civil rights, the principle that it's okay for government to come in from the federal level down to the local level and say, these kids must be in this school, which I agree with in that context. But the principle that government has that right explodes and now it's being expanded and wedged open. Until we're going to find that we have no rights. And we're going to find also that the way this goes down, the way it's wrapped up in civil rights and in what people believe makes you a good person, that too is going to, in a way, political correctness is ostracizing people, even for expressing doubts about things like whether genders are exactly the same and ought to have perfect representation in every industry and every occupation, because there's no biological basis for just different numbers of men and women in an organization. If we're to that point where you can't even articulate that, or else you're ostracized, then a lot of people are just going to believe what they're told to believe because it's easier. And eventually, your beliefs and the critical things that are irreducible in your understanding of yourself and the world will just, at some point or other, the I will turn to that, and you'll be made to disavow it. That's just the direction we're headed, and it's frightening. And on that happy note, I'm running out of time here, so I got to get going. I'll check back in next week. I'll have more. Let me know in the comments whether you agree, disagree, go to iTunes. I'm on there. Find Last Impressions, Justin Katz, and leave me 5 stars and a great review. And in the meantime, as I say every week, don't worry so much about first impressions, because those can be repaired. It's the final impressions, the last impressions, that can stay with you throughout eternity. God bless you all. Have a wonderful week.